In this next hour, we hear investigative reporter Lisa Graves. Lisa is the co-founder of Documented Investigations and president of True North Research, LLC. She's also the former executive director of the Center for Media and Democracy, which is based here in Madison. Lisa will share her groundbreaking research, some of which you may have read in the Washington Post and elsewhere, about how the right uses dark money and shadow organizations to capture the U.S. and state Supreme Courts. Lisa is miles ahead on this topic and has much to share. The talk took place on July 17, 2019, at the Madison Central Library and was sponsored by the American Constitution Society and the Madison Institute. This is the second in a three-part series titled Court Capture, the Right-Wing Takeover of the Judiciary. All three talks can be found at radioforall.net. That's radio, the number four, all.net. Now, Lisa Graves.
Well, good afternoon. I'm so excited to come speak with you today. I was really thrilled to get this invitation, and I wanted to just add a couple things about my bio. One is that I have been doing some research for and with the American Constitution Society on this question of court capture. Some of the things I'm going to talk about today are from that research. Some of the things I'm going to talk about today are from research before and subsequent to that. Without further ado, let me just say that I think I'm going to break this set of remarks into sort of three parts. The first is I'm going to focus a bit on Wisconsin. And second, I'm going to talk a little bit more about the national picture. And then last, I'm going to try to leave you with a little bit of hope, which can be hard in these very trying times. I'm actually speaking on Monday, not that I'm inviting you to it because it's in D.C., but I'm speaking on Monday at the Center for American Progress about whether the states have moved from being laboratories of democracy to laboratories of corruption. So I want to give due credit to them for that phrasing. I think that Wisconsin has become a laboratory of corruption. Let me just say that more directly. Wisconsin is a laboratory of corruption. And it's very sad for me to hear that because Wisconsin actually, prior to the last decade, had one of the finest traditions in the country, was in essence the star in terms of transparency, limits of outside money influence, limits of the power of lobbyists, and more, and it has been utterly corrupted by what some people call the conservative movement in this state. I think that's a misnomer. I don't think they're conservative at all. I think they're radically reactionary, and they're intent on destroying basic norms in our democracy without regard to the effect of them on the health of our democracy. Wisconsin. So I know that you all followed what happened in the election involving Judge Neubauer and now Justice Hagedorn. I was not involved in that election. I was watching that from, you know, afar, looking at that, looking at what was happening. And when the Wisconsin Realtors Association withdrew because of Brian Hagedorn's history of you know, advancing his own homophobic agenda, I was not confident that that was the end of the outside influence, that that was a sure thing. I thought that might be a feint in the sort of art of war. And then it turns out that perhaps it was. That's not to say that Wisconsin Realtors Association was coordinating with RSLC, but who's to say? Because Wisconsin has utterly destroyed, with the help of this Republican-controlled Senate, the rules regarding coordination that previously existed before that legislature and this Supreme Court in a, I think, highly biased and unjustified way, altered the rules in Wisconsin regarding coordination that affected elections. I could talk about that more at length, but I won't. So throughout most of that campaign, I would say for 51 weeks, it looked as though Judge Neubauer was ahead in the polling that was being published. Some of it looked like it was 8 points, 6 points, 7 points in that range, give or take the margin of error. And then suddenly, as you all know, 1 week before the election, $1 million came rushing into the state. Now, $1 million is a huge amount in the course of an election. $1 million in 1 week in this state with these media markets and in social media is like a nuclear bomb of cash. It is an unprecedented amount, especially since there was not the candidates were spending at a pretty similar pace. Judge Neubauer was spending at a slightly higher pace in terms of her own campaign expenditures than Hagedorn, but it was, you know, relatively even. There was not this sort of outside massive surge. So, you know, what happened? Well, you know, what happened was the Republican State Leadership Committee, one of the really quintessential dark money groups in this country that has emerged in the last decade, came forward. On March 25th, it reported it had raised no funds and spent no funds. You know, that's what they reported the state of Wisconsin. Oh, but what was RSLC doing behind the scenes? So turns out that on March 21st, 4 days before that disclosure, RSLC registered a website called ruleoflawjudge.com. You know, that was for Brian Hagedorn to help him. But before that, since the end of last year, it had raised more than $1 million to have an impact on judicial issues through what it calls the Judicial Fairness Project, a misnomer if ever there were one. Back in October 2018, it received money from huge money from a Wyoming LLC that was just created in October 2018, called Contract Drafting LLC, that goes to a law firm. No indication at all what contract drafting is, contract drafting LLC is whatsoever. JCN raised $700,000 then. Ultimately, RSLC's donors included Adelson, the famous casino billionaire who does not live here in Wisconsin. It included, that was $1 million from Adelson, $200,000 from Koch Industries, $500,000 from another of the right-wing billionaire Singer, money from Mallinckrodt, that's with a K-R-O-D-T, this Wyoming money from Eli Lilly, BNSF money, which is oil train money, or as a book that just came out this past week by Dismog, bomb train issues in terms of like the role of that of the rail industry in oil transportation and the concerns that the public has not heard about, and more. So somewhere between the time that RSLC raised, you know, more than $1 million at the end of 2018 for its Judicial Fairness Project and the day that it declared to Wisconsin that it had raised no money and spent no money, it had decided to spend money in Wisconsin and was preparing to do so. And then it subsequently filed its notice saying it was going to spend $1 million. That $1 million, 7 days before the election, that disclosure was amended on April 2nd to show that it spent $1.3 million, and that $1.3 million blew a hole in that election that basically got them a vote margin of less than 6,000 votes. It was an enormous sum. And the thing about the social media spending that a lot of people don't realize, even with the new disclosure policies of Facebook, is if you're not the target of those ads, you don't see them. You can only see the ones that you are the target of. So you probably saw some of them that were targeted Wisconsin, but you probably didn't see all of them. The other site that they purchased on the seventh day before the election, because they had, quote, raised no money and spent no money before then, was radicaljudge.org, which was an attack on liberal Lisa Neubauer. And they ran those ads hard. So we all know what happened. Judge Neubauer lost that election. Brian Hagedorn is on the Wisconsin Supreme Court. He had a come-from-behind finish with the help of a massive surge of money that the names I gave you are only the ones we know about. But because of the way RSLC puts the money into its Judicial Fairness Project, which then sort of launders the money through the way it doesn't disclose the fact that it raised money or who actually gave it the money for that 1 week surge in cash, it really is a dark money operation. Each of these groups, Koch Industries would say, well, we weren't involved in the Wisconsin election. We just gave them money to run in other elections, which is actually sort of what they said back in 2010 when David Koch put $1 million in the Republican Governors Association. Did all that money go to Scott Walker? Did it go to other governors? What portion was theirs? There was a bit of a dispute we had actually with the fact checker, with the fact checkers about whether AFP money and AFP expenditures were Coke expenditures because they're not all Coke industries. So these sort of hair-splitting things, which lawyers are very good at, if you draw back the lens and look at it quite plainly, what you see is a massive dark money campaign in Wisconsin that was aided and assisted in its own way by the Kochs, America's Prosperities, on the ground, get out the vote campaign here in the state, and it's door knocking, et cetera. So that's, you know, interesting. You have a judge on the Wisconsin Supreme Court who was put into place by interests. Many of the interests do have litigation before the court. Eli Lilly, for example, is one of the donors to RSLC. It has cases involving liability for its drugs and drug policy. Others of these may well have their own agenda before the Wisconsin Supreme Court. But we'll never know, because this dark money that has been unleashed in part through Citizens United is clouding public awareness of the way our courts are being distorted by these very, very special interests. Now, I wish I could tell you that this only happened in Wisconsin. When you look at the elections nationally and globally over the last 2 years, I think it would be a mistake not to be concerned about a trend. There was tremendous polling on Brexit that it was going to fail. It was going to fail, it was going to fail, it was going to fail. We now know there was massive social media effort, in part by some of the dark money billionaires in the United States, according to Cambridge Analytica and more, to try to sway that vote and push people's fears and push campaigns of fears based on massive data consolidation about who people are and what motivates them and what soccer team they like or what sport they like, and try to, you know, tailor ads and the like to them. Australia, just this past month, we saw a situation in which the more progressive party was seemingly ahead, and then all of a sudden, with a massive amount of money coming in, the more right-wing party won. We saw that with Trump. So I guess my question to you is, what's going to happen in 2020 and beyond? How can any candidate or any set of citizens prepare for the fact that at the very last minute, right before the election, a massive amount of cash can come bursting into the race with no disclosure to the public in real time or really ever about who that money is from, and utterly turn that race upside down, regardless of what the polling has been saying for 51 weeks. It is a massive crisis in the transparency of our government, in the functioning of our democracy. And I would say to you, it is a massive crisis in terms of me having confidence, and I'm sure some of you having confidence, in the integrity of our justice system, the integrity of our courts. We know from the way that the prior majority on that Wisconsin Supreme Court considered the rules for recusal that it didn't find any need to actually recuse itself when cases were brought to it by the very groups that helped push them into office. And we know that from the Wisconsin John Doe 2 investigation. We know that, and I helped my organization submitted an amicus brief to the United States Supreme Court asking for the West Virginia precedent of this United States Supreme Court on corruption and the distorting influence of money in an election of a justice of the Supreme Court to be applied in this case. And two of those justices on the Supreme Court, who are now gone, Prosser and Gableman, refused to recuse, even though you know, and I know, and the record shows, that they were absolutely helped by some of the groups that were under criminal investigation by a bipartisan set of investigators, of prosecutors, in this state. And they shut down that investigation, and they ordered that the materials from that investigation be destroyed. And then they left the court. But in the meantime, they had already basically agreed to the Wisconsin Manufacturing and Commerce's efforts to basically say they wouldn't have to recuse in such circumstances. When to any ordinary human being, any ordinary Wisconsin knight who's not so partisan they can't see the light in front of their face, that money obviously distorts. And even if they could say with confidence, it has zero effect on my impartiality in ruling on these cases, it certainly fails the test of baseline judicial ethics of having an appearance of unfairness, an appearance of untrustworthiness or impropriety, that you cannot have confidence that those judges who were helped into office by those groups didn't somehow favor the groups that helped them get their illustrious seats on our Supreme Court in Wisconsin. And it is morally wrong. And so at this point in this conversation, I would urge you to do whatever you can to speak out, to write letters, to write op-eds, to have your own meetings in your communities to talk about this. because our justice system, as you know, is supposed to be about the rule of law and not the rule of men. And we're supposed to have judges and justices we can have confidence in. And it is a shame. It is shameful that this Supreme Court, our Supreme Court, in this state, which has been at the forefront of transparency, has been so altered by this dark money.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Lisa Graves, an investigative reporter and co-founder of Documented Investigations and president of True North Research, LLC. She's speaking on her groundbreaking research on how the right uses dark money and shadow organizations to capture the U.S. and state Supreme Courts.
What happened last this spring is not the only information we have. Here's some of the research that my colleague and I did looking into Wisconsin's races. Some of this will be familiar with you, but let me just recap it. So we know, for example, that in 2016, a group called the Judicial Crisis Network gave $1.4 million to a group that emerged called the Wisconsin Alliance for Reform, WAR, which spent millions, at least $2.6 million in all, to secure the election of far-right candidate Rebecca Bradley for the Wisconsin Supreme Court. So, is it dark money? WAR says the money came from JCN. Ah, where'd the money come from JCN? You don't know. We don't know. Well, we think we may know, but we're investigating that in my little shop. But JCN, turns out, got donation from a single donor for like $24 million. I don't know about you. Do you have $24 million lying around? I mean, maybe you're like a Wall Street investor, venture capitalist, and you're like, well, you know, I could have another house in the Hamptons for like $24 million, or I could basically affect the Wisconsin Supreme Court and the United States Supreme Court, and hey, way better than a house, because they probably already have a couple houses, right? But for most people, a $24 million donation is unheard of. It's almost unimaginable. Now, I've watched these billionaires for a number of years, and I know, for example, when the Koch brothers want their name on something, oh, they put it on there. You go to the David Koch wing in New York for the ballet. You can see the David Koch wing at the Natural History Museum. You can see the David Koch arm of one of the research centers at a hospital. So they're perfectly happy not being anonymous when it makes them look better, when they're basically greed washing their money. But when billionaires like the Kochs, and I don't know that it is the Kochs, and I'm not saying to you it is the Kochs, but when they want to be anonymous, they are anonymous. And there's nothing in the law as it currently exists that compels their disclosure. In fact, the law does not require JCN to disclose its donors. And now, in this administration, in the next set of financial forms for JCN, I think it's the case that we will not even know that there was a donor of undisclosed name who gave a specific amount, because they've changed the rules for the Schedule Bs of the 990 tax forms, which is where you could just see just the bare minimum that there were like maybe three donors or five donors, and these are the big amounts, without any other details. That's too much transparency for these guys to bear. They don't even want to know that, they don't want you to know that there was a $24 million donation from one person or one entity or one corporation. Which one? What's their agenda for our courts? What else did JCN do? They made more than $100K in ad buys to support the election of Brad Schimmel for Attorney General in 2014. They gave at least $825,000 to the state chamber affiliate, along with the Rule of Law Project, another project that's part of this nest of groups I'm going to talk about in a minute. They also gave $400,000 to Wisconsin Club for Growth, which was led by Eric O'Keefe, a longtime Koch brother from way back, a Koch buddy basically from the early 1980s, but operated in essence by R.J. Johnson, one of the lead dark money operatives in the state of Wisconsin. Back in 2013, JCN gave Wisconsin Club for Growth that money to help Pat Rogensack win her state reelection. And then, of course, JCN, that's not all it did. Back in 2008, it filtered money through business groups to get Gableman elected. Like JCN, RLC also spent money in prior elections. I'm not going to go into that because I want to focus on some other things. If you want those details, I'm hoping that we'll be able to get that material out through with ACS, this particular set of historical research from 2016 and prior. What I discovered in my research, separate from this set for ACS, is that the relationship between some of these groups and Wisconsin is much deeper than people know. And so I'm going to tell you some things that I would bet no one in this room or no one who's going to be listening to this on the air knows. One of the things I do when I'm researching an issue is I go back and look at all the other research that's been that I can find about that group. Prior leaks, leaks that are out there where maybe I looked at, for example, the Bradley documents that leaked in 2016 to see at the time, maybe when I first saw them, I looked for like this group. You know, what was this group doing? And I didn't look at everything because there's just too much to look at. So in this case, I basically went back through every single leak I could find in the newspapers about any Wisconsin elections. And what I discovered was that in the John Doe investigation material that was leaked to The Guardian in the story that ran in September of 2016, I think that's right, that Leonard Leo is in those documents. Now, who is Leonard Leo? Leonard Leo is the vice president of the Federalist Society. ACS does not have a position on the Federalist Society. They are sort of, in their view, a counterweight to the Federalist Society, progressive group of lawyers and legal folks. Federalist Society is the sort of conservative or self-described conservative counterweight to that. That's what Leonard Leo's day job is. He is the vice president of the Federalist Society, which was founded in the early 1980s to build an infrastructure to get lawyers to advance their ideas, their agenda in the law in whatever way they can. It turns out, as the Washington Post documented in a story that was published in May, it turns out that Leonard Leo sits sort of at the center point of a network of groups, some of which he controls or were registered by him, where he's the, quote, only employee of, or where he is fundraising for these other groups. He sits at the center of a $250 million dark money network. The story of that research by the Washington Post, by Bob O'Hara and Sean Boberg, is detailed in their story that's published there, along with a documentary film that they have on site. And then they also have a podcast. If you prefer podcasts, there's a sort of a podcast version of that. So all media options are available to you to get a better look at that. What the Post uncovered was how Leo, Leonard Leo, had basically created a role, he says separate from the Federal Society, technically legally separate, but the Judicial Crisis Network, it turns out the Washington Post discovered, was just down the hall from the Federal Society, like the same hall. Don't know whether there's any internal office doors, who knows, doesn't really matter, because one of the groups that was doing comms work for Judicial Crisis Network and Leonard Leo. One of the guys from that group said that basically JCN was Leonard Leo's operation. It was his sort of PR comms operation. And he also said that the head of JCN and her children would play in Leo's office and, you know, vice versa. They just hang out together over there. It's a pretty close relationship. Leo told the Post that, he's an ideas man. He doesn't concern himself with money. But lo and behold, in the Wisconsin John Doe files that The Guardian published, Leonard Leo is in there when they're looking for money to try to help with that coordinated campaign involving trying to defend Scott Walker from recall and trying to defend those state senators who are facing recall and trying to make sure that Prosser got elected to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Who do they say they were going to reach out to money for money? Leonard Leo. Leonard Leo. Now, the story gets more interesting. This is another part of the story that I don't think has been covered anywhere. And if you'd like to write about it, please feel free. Judicial Crisis Network is a C4 organization, which is a 501c4, meaning it's a nonprofit that doesn't pay taxes on its revenue, but you don't get a full tax deduction if you donate to them. A Judicial Crisis Network has a 501c3 arm called Judicial Education Project, JEP. So I've looked through the entire record of anything that JEP has done, and it turns out JEP is the only nonprofit known in the entire United States of all the databases that are available to have donated any money to the R.J. Johnson Legal Defense Fund for when he was under criminal investigation by the bipartisan county prosecutors here in Wisconsin. Wow, it's really interesting that this group called the Judicial Education Project, that in its day job appears to be just writing amicus briefs arguing for extreme positions of the law, somehow gets cash passed to it to pony up more than $2 million to help defend the kingpin of the Wisconsin dark money operation. That's pretty significant. Who received that? Where is this R.J. Johnson Legal Defense Fund? It's like at a P.O. box on the east coast of Wisconsin with no further details of how that money was spent, which lawyers got that money, where it went. Zero disclosure. It's interesting to me, even though I understand that politicians sometimes will form a legal defense fund and there'll be donations to those legal defense funds, it's interesting to me that we don't know who funded basically the defense of R.J. Johnson in the middle of the criminal investigation involving his role in orchestrating that massive dark money campaign, which this Wisconsin Supreme Court has ruled to be legal, even though at the time I believe, and the prosecutors strongly believed, and the evidence showed that it was not lawful, and it surrounded Walker, who called R.J. Johnson his man, despite the fact that the Bradley Foundation was actually the official sort of campaign chairman at one point. R.J. was the guy pulling the shots, and as you could see from the documents that The Guardian published, that was the plan. They didn't want other outside groups to be spending money in ways that weren't coordinated that might hit the wrong note. They demanded centralization of that money and that spending. And when that story broke, my organization at the time, the Center for Media Democracy, PR Watch, went through those files and pulled out the checks. And the checks were the calendar was Scott Walker leaving this capital going to billionaires, including Donald Trump, by the way, across the country to raise money for what the donors described in their check memos as Scott Walker's C4. A C4 that, which was Wisconsin Club for Growth, by the way, a C4 that supposedly was independent of the campaign, supposedly was not illegally coordinating, but the American people, the Wisconsin citizens, the Wisconsinites, did not know that that was happening at the time those recalls were going on. It also turned out, by the way, and we helped uncover this, that the group that ran the ads at the very end of that recall session in May and June of 2012, saying that recall was not the Wisconsin way, was not a Wisconsin group. It was another murky, dark money group operating out of the state of Virginia with murky ties. And also, of course, Americans for Prosperity and other groups were spending millions of dollars on their own push toward saving Scott Walker's seat. So that's sort of the Wisconsin part of that story. And I think it's worth further investigation. I think it's worth further examination of that relationship. Why is this group in Washington so concerned about being the only funder of R.J. Johnson's legal defense fund? Who are they protecting in defending him? I think that's a worthy question. I don't know who they're protecting. I think the public should know. I don't think we'll ever know because of the actions of this Wisconsin Supreme Court and that state legislature. But let's talk a little bit more about Leonard Leo. I've got so much time. You're going to get an earful. Do you mind if I just get a drink of water? I have deep sympathy for Marco Rubio. But let's talk about what Leonard Leo is doing, what this means for the broader context. So that Washington Post story uncovered audio of Leonard Leo speaking to a group called the Council for National Policy, CNP. CNP describes itself as sort of a conservative, sort of religious right organization where they sort of set a policy agenda for America, and they have sort of the big right-wing operatives are there. Jenny Thomas, Clarence Thomas's wife, is a prominent speaker at this CNP, Council on National Policy. The Southern Poverty Law Center has documented substantial information about CNP. We've also been looking into them, my goodness, to see, based on these revelations and SPLC's work, how tied in this infrastructure is with sort of the policy-making agenda for the nation.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Lisa Graves, an investigative reporter and co-founder of Documented Investigations and president of True North Research, LLC. She's speaking on her groundbreaking research on how the right uses dark money and shadow organizations to capture the U.S. and state Supreme Courts.
But what the Post discovered was that Leo gave a speech this spring to the donors in that room and the activists in that room saying that, and I'm going to paraphrase here, but it's pretty close, saying that America was on the precipice of the revival of the structural constitution. Have you all heard about the structural constitution? Yeah, you know, I mean, I follow this one, you know, this one here, which is called the United States Constitution. But these guys are promoting what they are calling the structural constitution, the revival of the structural constitution. And he extolled the room there with information about this structural revolution. And he said to them that no one alive in this room was present for the kind of structural changes that are about to unfold from this United States Supreme Court. No one alive in that room had seen what the sort of magnitude of change, of legal changes that through his work working with Trump to change our United States Supreme Court, to get Gorsuch on the court, Neil Gorsuch on the court, and Brett Kavanaugh on the court, we were going to have massive structural change and a revival of it. And it would basically turn the law back more than 100 years. More than 100 years. So pre-New Deal. And I'm going to pause there and come back to that in a second. So how did Leo accomplish this, getting the pieces in place for this structural revival that we're about to experience without any public debate about what it is and what it means for our lives as Americans? You know, he got involved in the Federal Society back in the, you know, a couple decades ago, basically, and he was also actively involved in the creation of, you guessed it, the Judicial Crisis Network. I knew you were going to guess it, right? Back in late 2004, 2005. So George W. Bush wins election after he was put on the court through the U.S. Supreme Court decision in 2000, Bush v. Gore. So he wins election in 2004. And afterwards, Leo, along with a couple other people, get together and they decide they're going to create a thing called the Judicial Confirmation Network, which then changes its name to become the Judicial Crisis Network. And one of the first things they do is they help get John Roberts and Samuel Alito on the U.S. Supreme Court back in 2005 and 2006. Then the Judicial Crisis Network is a little bit less active at the end of the Bush administration. Then when Obama comes in, they're more active. They're actively opposing the nominees of President Obama. And then by 2010, they're basically working with another group, which I'm going to add another group to your equation here, the Independent Women's Forum, the leader of that, Heather Higgins, and the head of the Judicial Crisis Network, on a whole set of dark money operations. So Heather Higgins, who is the heir to the Vicks VapoRub fortune, she works with the Kochs at their 2010 summit to basically help move money into a thing that you may have heard of called the CPPR, which is the Committee to Protect Patient Rights, or the Center to Protect Patient Rights, and has another part to it, which was ultimately subject to legal sanctions in California and other and federally for its operations. It's its own shell game of money in the 2010, 2011, 2012 in the 2012 elections. Pardon me. But then also JCN received a surge of cash by way of a new group that was created. I know it's just like group, you know, how can you keep track of all these groups? A new group called the Wellspring Committee. The Wellspring Committee was created at that same time. And who was involved in the Wellspring Committee? Leonard Leo, right? And who does Wellspring Committee give most of his money to? Judicial Crisis Network. So basically what they're doing is they see Citizens United coming. They actually are, I think in many ways, the Kochs were instrumental in helping to put the pieces in place for that. The decision comes down in January of 2010 to destroy the ability of Congress to regulate the spending by so-called outside money groups in our election, because Justice Kennedy claims that they'll be independent of the candidate, which certainly didn't happen in Wisconsin when Walker's right-hand guy was the guy raising money and Walker was running around raising money for the group spending money in that election. But Justice Kennedy claims, and there will be disclosure, which he knows does not actually exist, that there wasn't a disclosure regime. And then the Republican Party in Congress refuses to do anything to redress Citizens United, to have any disclosure of this money being spent by these so-called outside money groups that are unleashed by Citizens United. There were obviously problems in our election system with dark money, soft money before Citizens United, but Citizens United put it on steroids. And what we've witnessed in the last 10 years has been a tsunami of dark money, infiltrating elections at almost every level. And the guy who's been most involved in that in the judicial arena, who most people didn't know his name until Trump tapped him to be his judge whisperer, on the pre-selection of who Trump would choose from, is Leonard Leo. Now, the Federalist Society said that Leo leaves his day job and is sort of on leave when he's advising Trump. We know that from the Washington Post investigation that he has had, at least in one case, a major increase in his salary while he was, you know, the year he was on leave. But also, he has been making substantial money from his dark money operations, it appears. What the Washington Post uncovered was just astonishing. They found that he created one group, BH Fund, and another group called BH Group. One is a nonprofit, one is a for-profit. And one of the groups describes itself as basically advising donors and also advising groups. So he basically is sort of in the business of marrying donors with groups that he, you know, works with and helps, like Judicial Crisis Network, Wellspring Committee, some of these other groups. Leonard Leo, in 2018, as Kavanaugh was nominated to the U.S. Supreme Court, he paid off his mortgage. Who knows? Maybe he got bonuses. Maybe the stock market is helping him an awful lot. I don't know. These are questions that I think are reasonable to ask about the person who is operating without any public disclosure, not as a public employee, advising the president about who should become a judge, and basically choosing who the president chooses from, which is really the ultimate power. You can choose whomever you choose. Leo and Trump conferred at length. Brett Kavanaugh was not on the original list of Trump's potential Supreme Court justices. He was added in 2017. Was it late 2016? I'll get my date straight. He was added after the election. I think it was 2017. Late. Why? Who knows? Well, then it turned out that the justice he clerked for, Justice Kennedy, suddenly announced his retirement in the summer of 2018. And Trump chose his clerk to take his seat, almost like it was like a seat to be given to someone's clerk forever and ever and ever. You know, like this is sort of this new thing they may be attempting. But the mortgage was sort of like, you know, people have mortgages. Sometimes you can pay them off. You know, it could be completely legit, and I would not want to suggest that anything unlawful happened. But what happened lawfully is Leo has other sources of income from big donors that are active in trying to influence legal policy and these issues. But what really caught my eye was that on the day that the United States Senate had its vote for cloture on Brett Kavanaugh's nomination, after the incredible tumult surrounding him, the day that the United States Senate, with Mitch McConnell at the helm, pushed the vote to ensure that Kavanaugh would get a confirmation vote the next day, that day is the day that Leonard Leo closed on a mansion in Maine on Mount Desert Island, in that Bar Harbor part of Maine. It's a property that's like worth more than $3 million. And he closed on it the day of the cloture vote. It has a nice view of the yacht club up there. Now, you know, he clearly is doing well in this work that he's doing. For the Federal Society, it's a six-figure salary. For the for-profit entity, you can see him ask that question on film in the documentary, the documentary investigator uncovered. And he basically blanches and says, that's private, and I'm not a money guy, I'm an idea guy. But clearly there's some money happening. And I would say to you, whether it's, no matter what you think about Leo and his agenda, I don't care whether he was progressive, independent, Republican, conservative, reactionary. I don't think anyone who is playing such a central role in deciding who gets on the U.S. Supreme Court should have zero disclosure of where they're getting money, especially in the middle of the confirmation of those justices. So it turns out that Leo and Brett Kavanaugh are really good friends. There's a picture of them in Leo's office. It says, "Who's the boss?" on it. You can't make this up. The Washington Post, I mean, their investigative team is so amazing. They went back to the high school yearbook of Leonard Leo, and it was like that movie Body Heat. You know, for those of you, I'm going to spoil the ending, where at the end the woman wants to get rich and live in an exotic land. Leonard Leo's yearbook nickname was like Moneybags, and his aspiration was to get rich. And he has, in part through playing such a central role in who gets on our court. Now, he said it in his speech to the Council of National Policy that, of course, he doesn't decide. That's Trump's decision. Trump makes that decision. But he decides who he picks from, which is really the power behind the throne, as it were. So that's not all. That Wellspring Committee had a sort of a surge in cash right after Justice Scalia passed away. And Leonard Leo created at least three of these groups that are sort of part of this calculation by the Washington Post after Justice Scalia passed away, other vehicles to move cash around. And it turned out that substantial millions of dollars were spent to help Gorsuch get control. Well, let me just take a step back. To stop Merrick Garland, President Obama's widely respected, not controversial nominee, from being confirmed to the United States Supreme Court in 2016, to stop that. These groups that are connected to Leonard Leo, like Independent Women's Forum and Judicial Crisis Network and more, spent huge money to try to stop him from being confirmed, and then spent huge money to get Gorsuch confirmed and basically put pressure on any so-called weak Dem, like the senator from West Virginia, Joe Manchin, or others, to try to make sure that Gorsuch would get through. And then they spent an untold sum basically helping Brett Kavanaugh before the controversy, the greater controversy arose about him, after I wrote about how he had, in my view, lied under oath in his confirmation hearings in 2004 and 2005, and then again in 2018 about documents that were taken from the United States Senate and his receipt of stolen documents. And then, obviously, we all saw what happened with the eyewitness testimony of Dr. Christine Blasey Ford that Kavanaugh rejected in his tirade that provoked Justice Stevens, who, I'm sorry, has passed away in these past 24 hours, but provoked Justice Stevens to take the rare step of basically expressing his concerns about the temperament of Kavanaugh for the Supreme Court. But in fact, as you know, he's on the U.S. Supreme Court. So Carolyn Fredrickson, the president of ACS, and I wrote an op-ed in National Journal talking about this $250 million question, what it means to America to have this much money being spent around our United States Supreme Court and not knowing where that money is coming from, whose agenda is being advanced. Because I'll tell you what, you may give $20 or $50 or $100 to a candidate and think, because that candidate believes what I think and is going to, help make our world a better place in this election. A billionaire is not giving $25 million just because altruistically they have no agenda for the United States Supreme Court. They're not giving that money to Wellspring to give to JCN because, they just woke up one day and they're just like, hey, in general, I just, want to give away cash. It's transactional. They want something. That means I'm 10 minutes away. Okay. They want something. What do they want? We don't know. But you know who knows? Leonard Leo probably knows because he's the one helping to solicit the money from them. And then he's the one helping to choose who gets chosen to help accomplish their agenda. So let me talk about that agenda, and then I will hit the heroes part at the very end here.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Lisa Graves, an investigative reporter and co-founder of Documented Investigations and president of True North Research, LLC. She's speaking on her groundbreaking research on how the right uses dark money and shadow organizations to capture the U.S. and state Supreme Courts.
What does it mean to go back to the laws that existed before the New Deal? I know many of you in the room are lawyers, and you know that that was the Lochner era. It was the Gilded Age. It was this period of our legal system, our court system, in which the progressive legislation was struck down by courts under claims of freedom of contract or other substantive due process, quote, substantive due process or other sort of judicial creations to try to stop those democratic movements in their tracks. It was also a very terrible period of American history in which corporations could discriminate against people, against people based on their race, and governments could as well. Professor Jamal Green wrote an op-ed following the Washington Post story that illuminated some of these issues. But we've already seen part of that structural revolution happening. We saw it. I think the really first pillar of that was Citizens United, to destroy the ability of Congress to regulate the spending by these billionaires who have a keen interest in who is on our Supreme Court and who is in our state legislatures. Citizens United is one pillar. Then we saw the Voting Rights Act decision, the Shelby County decision coming out of Alabama, which really decimated the ability to enforce the landmark Voting Rights Act of 1965. So that's a major issue in terms of enforcement of voting rights at a time when there's truly frightening partisanship trying to take away the right to vote of citizens of Wisconsin and other states. And then we saw just this past month in the two cases coming out of North Carolina and Maryland, the U.S. Supreme Court basically saying federal courts cannot resolve these issues of extreme partisan gerrymandering. They're not going to get involved. They refuse to take up the Gill case that we, when I was at CMD, we supported the court taking cert in that case and more. They refused. So voting rights, money in our elections, how the elections are structured, who you get to vote for, who you have the privilege to vote for if it's been gerrymandered, those things are basically off the table. So that's just the beginning of this agenda. That laissez-faire sort of from the government standpoint, but that sort of laissez-faire agenda activism can be heard in the remarks of then Federal Society advisor Antonin Scalia at the group's first national meeting in the early 1980s. He said, quote, "The free market has the ability to order things in the most efficient manner and generally should be allowed to operate free of government intervention." I'm just going to read this for a second. That dogma, which has also been dubbed public choice theory, has now been fully infused into a radically reactionary agenda to reverse a century of legal protections for the actual public interest, many of which were actually adopted by large legislative majorities with bipartisan support. And Professor Nancy McLean, I don't know if you've read Democracy and Change, she wrote a great book 2 years ago that really describes how Charles Koch was one of the funders of this. He's not the only one. Again, we don't know who the billionaires are who are funding this because it is hidden. But she talked about how he was trying to put democracy in chains, how their agenda was designed to limit the power of our democracy. So when you think of Citizens United limiting the power of Congress, we really need to think about it limiting the power of we, the people. And that's, in fact, how we should be seeing, you know, all of this. This is when you see a Koch group that says something like limited government, that's really a sort of fancy way of saying, or, you know, a way to obscure limited democracy. So, I really only have 6 minutes. Okay. It went so fast. I've been looking into this, you know, obviously I've been studying originalism for a long time, since the late 1980s. It, you know, comes in various forms. We hear all these different doctrines. Sometimes it's called originalism. Sometimes there are people who advocate a very historical approach. Sometimes they have called it this structural constitution. Sometimes in the economic sphere, it's called public choice theory. It goes by a whole variety of names. But at its root, it's about limiting the power of people in our democracy and restoring this previous order, this order that existed prior to the New Deal, in which the most powerful interests in our society. We're in the driver's seat with our legislatures and with our courts. And so one of the things that they have talked about, these acolytes, including one of Justice Thomas's clerks, and by the way, a third of the judges on the U.S. federal courts appointed by Trump are Thomas clerks. One third. But one of the prominent Thomas clerks, who's a professor of law, I debated a couple months ago, and he said that it all really comes down to Article 1, Section 1. So I'm going to read it to you. All legislative powers herein shall be vested in a Congress of the United States, which shall consist of a Senate and House of Representatives. That doesn't seem like a very radical proposition. It's the first article following the preamble. All legislative powers herein shall be vested. But when you ask them about it, what they say is, therefore, Congress cannot empower a legislative agency to engage in legislative activity, meaning rulemaking. So instead of basically destroying the federal government by destroying these agencies through taking away their money, which is underway, or having them lose their intellectual capital, which is underway in terms of people leaving those agencies, this is a legal method to basically say Congress cannot even create an agency that would do X or Y, that would engage in rulemaking. And we know that they have had in their scope a number of agencies that they wish did not exist at all. But then they refer to the fact that in the Article 3, all judicial powers are vested in the courts. So then can we have administrative law judges who are adjudicating these cases? Oh, then of course they also point to the vesting of executive power in Article 2 as basically advancing their theory of unitary executive power, of that there could be no independent federal agency. Like, the Federal Reserve would be completely a creature of Trump without any bound. The FBI, any agency head could be fired without regard to any rules or processes to have an independent or quasi-independent agency. It's really nothing short than the most reactionary agenda possible to dramatically change our laws. And I did promise you a moment of hope, and I've almost run out of time. So I guess I would say to you before the time ends, if you are shocked by this and outraged by this, which, you know, I certainly hope you are genuinely, legitimately, fairly outraged by it, because I think it is, in fact, outrageous, there are many other people in this country who are waking up to what's happening to our courts, who are very concerned about the United States Supreme Court and very concerned about their state courts. They're engaged in a number of activities to try to restore transparency, to try to restore judicial ethics. And in Wisconsin, as many of you know, there was a really historic effort by retired judges in this state to go around the state and talk about the judicial ethics issues, the recusal issues, and why they mattered for the integrity of our court. And I think we have an obligation as lawyers, as people who are interested in law, or people who care about the state of our democracy, to be thinking big and thinking broadly about where we need to be talking to people about these issues and who we can join with to talk about these issues, to wake people up to what's happening. It could be a local group in Madison. It could be doing a lecture series across the state. It could be op-eds. It could be around Law Day. There's a range of things that need to happen to really wake people up, including really other lawyers, about what's happening. This is not just there's two sides and sometimes the pendulum swings and then, you know, it's conservative and progressive or whatever. This is a structural revolution, and the guy at the head of it is raising millions and millions of dollars and helping get that money spent and filtered through these other organizations. And that money is affecting not just the federal judiciary, but also the states. And so, as Carolyn Fredrickson and I said, this is the $250 million question that everyone should be asking about. Who is funding? Who are the dark money forces funding the effort to get really right-wing judges and justices on our highest courts in our country? And what is their agenda? And what does it mean for us as a people? I'm here to talk about this and also enlist your help as civic-minded people to speak out, learn more, and take action to help wake more people up about this crisis. So, those are my remarks. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to investigative reporter Lisa Graves speaking on how the right uses dark money and shadow organizations to capture the U.S. and state Supreme Courts. She's the co-founder of Documented Investigations and president of True North Research, LLC. She's also the former executive director of the Center for Media and Democracy, which is based here in Madison. The talk took place on July 17, 2019, at the Madison Central Library and was sponsored by the American Constitution Society and the Madison Institute. This is the second of a three-part series titled Court Capture, the Right-Wing Takeover of the Judiciary. All three talks can be found at radioforall.net. That's radio, the number four, dot net. And to find out about upcoming events from these two sponsors, go to acslaw.org and themadisoninstitute.org.